You're listening to the Stephen Wolfram Podcast, an exploration of thoughts and ideas from the founder and CEO of Wolfram Research, creator of Mathematica, and Wolfram Alpha. Coming up, the first episode in a three-part series exploring the future of AI and civilization, recorded live at the Wolfram Summer School at Bentley University. In this first episode, Stephen gives an overview on his thoughts on theories of ethics, symbolic discourse language, and the possibilities of digitized humanity. Let's have a listen.
So I said I would talk about AI in the future. So I want to talk about kind of what the trajectory of technology, where it's going, and what it means kind of for the future of us humans. So I guess the first thing to realize is, you know, if you kind of look at human history, there are lots of things that have kind of been somewhat unchanged in human history about the human condition and so on, and the way that humans think about things. But the one thing that's kind of a continual flow in human history is the advance of technology. And that's the thing, you know, you look at an old movie or something, or you look at something from you know, some illustration from the past, the one thing that's an immediate, okay, there are clothing styles and so on, but beyond that, the one immediate giveaway is what's the state of technology at that point in history. And that's been, that's kind of something that we can kind of see as something that sort of progressively advanced through history. And I guess the question, sort of at a meta level, is what is technology and what is it kind of doing for us? And I think the answer to that is, in large part, it's taking things that we used to have to do ourselves and it's somehow automating those things. And kind of the role of technology is to take things we kind of knew we wanted to do and to make those things automatic to do. And a typical kind of mode of operation of technology is you look at what exists in the material world and you try to sort of mine it and you try and entrain it for human purposes. So whether that's, you notice that you can take a donkey and you can have it move things, or you notice that you can take a magnet, a ferromagnet, and you can use that to make a compass or whatever else. You're kind of taking things from the material world and you're entraining them for some human purpose. So I guess the question as one looks at sort of the arc of future technology is, okay, to what extent can we kind of take, can we continue with this trend of doing things where we kind of know we want to do something and then we automate that and turn it into a piece of technology? We entrain something from the material world to generate a way of doing what we wanted to do automatically. And I guess in today's times, you know, the fastest moving part of that sort of technology story is things relating to software. And the thing that has been exciting for me to see is the whole sort of interaction of NKS with that process. And the whole point of, you want to build a piece of technology, how do you get that technology? Do you have to sort of build it step by step? Or can you kind of discover useful technology just from exploring the computational universe and grabbing something that represents a particular piece of technology? So for example, you know, in the traditional way of building things in engineering and so on, is you say, okay, we know these building blocks, we're going to move step by step towards the objective that we have and make that and sort of understand every step of what we're doing and create something which achieves the objective we want. Kind of the approach that's more of the kind of explore the computational universe approach is, okay, we can define some algorithm roughly that we want, and then we go out and from the computational universe, we search for something that satisfies the criteria we want, and then we use that to achieve that technological objective. So, I mean, I guess the way of thinking about that is this kind of what exists in computation is this kind of sea of capabilities, and on the other side are the things that we humans want to do, and sort of the challenge is to go out into this kind of sea of possible computational possibilities and grab the things that are relevant to us as humans. So I guess the big thing about that in today's world is kind of the AI direction and the fact that we're seeing things that we used to think were pure sort of human cognitive processing becoming things which we can readily do with in some kind of computational way. Sort of interesting to see the interplay between the kind of just explore the computational universe from NKS and the world of deep learning and so on, because these are actually pretty similar ideas. Take this ocean of sort of computational possibilities and go and sort of do this big search and grab a piece out of that ocean of computational possibilities, In the other case, in the case of neural networks, we again have this big sort of ocean of computational possibilities. But thanks to calculus and so on, in the kind of deep learning world, we have this kind of incremental way of exploring this sort of ocean of computational possibilities using essentially incremental calculus type ideas and gradient descent and backpropagation, all those kinds of things. But it's very much the same kind of idea as the perhaps more extreme NKS idea of just going out into this computational universe of possibilities and grabbing what we want. So kind of the idea here is, you know, we've got this sort of ocean of computational possibilities, we've got the things that we want to do, and we are gradually figuring out how to make use of this kind of ocean of computational possibilities to get done the things we want to do. Now, turns out a big part of the question of what's going to happen depends on how we describe the things we want to do. And kind of I view my sort of life in doing things like language design as an attempt to bridge those two parts. That is, to have a language in which we as humans can describe what we want to do, but which is capable of exercising a large part of this computational ocean of possibilities. And I think the thing that is kind of put into, as we talk about AI and what is possible in AI, it eventually becomes a big mirror on what do we actually as humans want to do. So one of the issues, one of the things that comes up very quickly is the whole AI ethics question of, okay, so how do we generally tell the AIs what we want them to do? You know, as we make more and more systems in the world dependent on AI, whether that's, you know, how we drive cars, run central banks, whatever else, all these things will eventually, it will be more efficient to use AI than to use humans to do these things, not least because it's easier for AI to get sort of more input than a human can deal with. So then the question is, so what do we generally tell the AIs to do? What is the general goal of running the central bank? What's the general goal of what to do when you're driving the car in some complicated situation where somebody might get hurt, but you have to decide who type thing? So what is the sort of general principle that you use to decide these things? And that's something that it's, again, we have to be able to have some description of what it is we want to have happen. I mean, throughout history, people have wondered, you know, what's the big theory of ethics? And there isn't really a big theory of ethics. It's really a question of what do people want to have happen. So you can say, well, I want the, you know, you want to run the central bank so that the maximum number of people are maximally happy. Well, what does that mean? You have some function, you know, you have this distribution of people, this level of happiness. You can kind of decide that, okay, you know, utilitarianism means this particular thing about the, you know, the median of the distribution is this, the quantiles of the distribution are that, and so on. That's a thing where, you know, all these things which kind of were at a time kind of questions for philosophers now become something where you have to have some definite way of saying what you want the AI to do. And that's sort of an interesting case because it's, you know, one of the questions is there a meta way to understand what to tell the AI to do? So, you know, one thing you could do is say, have the AI, you know, watch every YouTube video and just, you know, do what the humans do, which is obviously a pretty stupid idea. Then you can say, well, let's just go and, you know, convene a panel of philosophers to decide what the AI should do. Also a dubious idea, to convene a panel of politicians to decide what the AI should do, possibly what will happen in practice, but also perhaps not the best of ideas. But the question is there some, you know, is there some theoretical basis for, you know, the what should the AI do question? It's sort of interesting as one looks at kind of the set of things that are possible to do in the universe and that we can achieve and automate and so on. The, you know, once you've given an AI, a system, a goal, go achieve this, achieving that goal and optimizing achieving that goal is something that you can realistically expect technology to do. Defining what that goal should be is something that you cannot expect technology to do. It's something that is fundamentally not within the domain of technology to do that. It's like saying, you know, in other words, to do the thing and even to optimize doing the thing, that's something you can expect to automate. But there is no sort of perfect definition of, so what should the goal be? You know, what is the perfect, you know, goal? What is the sort of mathematically defined goal? It's not, I don't think there really is one. I mean, the best one can say is that if the thing doesn't exist, then it's out of the game. So existence is, in a sense, a very baseline kind of goal. But beyond that, it's hard to see how you define a goal. The goals you have to define are ones that have to be a reflection of our human history and culture and so on, and they are, you know, they are basically a mirror back on what we humans want to have happen. And that's, you know, that it's hard to encapsulate that. I think the best we can do is to try to say, well, how would we explain what these goals should be? And then we realize, well, we have to have some kind of language, some kind of way to describe the goals we want. Because as I say, it doesn't really work to just say, watch what the humans do. It doesn't really work to have some kind of theorem that says, you know, the goal of everything should be blank. You know, the blank, again, has been debated by philosophers for a couple of thousand years. And it's pretty clear there is no well-defined blank. You know, you can say the goal of everything is to make the world as interesting as possible. Okay, I don't know whether that's the goal. I'm not sure that is the goal. The goal might be to make everybody as happy as possible, which might not at all be to make the world as interesting as possible. So, you know, one realizes there really isn't a way to define sort of a perfect goal. But the first step is to just even have a way to describe, if we do have an idea of what the goal should be, how do we actually describe it to the machines? And that's what a lot of things I've been interested in about defining a symbolic discourse language that can represent kind of everyday concepts that we have and can basically define what amounts to a set of things that are like human laws that can tell machines what we want to have happen. I mean, if we ask about the way that human organizations work and sort of human society works, what has evolved is this idea of laws where you define in some essentially symbolic way what you want to be the way that the civilization should operate. And that's what, one of the things that's interesting about laws is they're not particularly simple. You know, if you look at, constitutions may start fairly simple, but then the actual body of laws that govern the operation of a country, for example, ends up being really quite complicated. So one question is that complexity unnecessary? And that's sort of an interesting thing to think about from a theoretical point of view, with when one thinks about computational irreducibility and how sort of things in the world work. Because what one realizes is that the question of whether there exists sort of a simple set of laws that can define one to have what one wants to have happen in this sort of computational irreducible world and not other stuff, one realizes that that is impossible. And it's basically a consequence of Gödel's theorem that it's impossible. And here's the way to think about that. So, you know, in Gödel's theorem, sort of done in the context of mathematics, one's interested in saying, the Gödel's theorem in particular operates in the domain of arithmetic and particularly in the axioms of Peano arithmetic and so on. And Gödel's theorem tries to say, okay, we want to set things up so that we are describing just the integers and nothing but the integers. We want to have a set of axioms, a set of constraints effectively, a set of things that are like laws that say the thing we're talking about is just the integers. I don't want these integers to misbehave in any way. I just want them to be the integers doing all the usual things that integers do. So we try and set up this essentially system of laws to say it's just the integers and nothing but the integers. Okay, so the big point of Gödel's theorem is that's not possible. There is no finite set of axioms that will carve out just the integers and nothing but the integers. And that's a consequence of, you know, you can see it as a consequence of computational irreducibility. It's the computational irreducibility of processes and arithmetic effectively that mean that there is no kind of finite way to sculpt this thing of being just the integers. So that the exact same phenomenon implies that in a world where the things that can happen involve computational irreducibility, even if you've got some criterion in your mind about what should be happening, there will be no way to expect to have sort of a finite set of laws that will never have unexpected consequences. So it's kind of a thing where, as you say, I just want the right things to happen in the world. Well, okay, you define what those are, but it'll turn out there's always some weird thing that was a case you didn't consider that will have to be sort of separately dealt with. So it means that what I think as a practical matter one realizes is that one's going to end up with, you know, the constitution for the AIs ends up being some pretty complicated thing. It's a little bit like human laws that describe sort of what we currently understand about how we want the world to work in the world where there are AIs and humans and just AIs and so on and so on and so on. And sort of a complicated thing. And the first step is having a symbolic discourse language where we can even describe what we want. The next question is, what should we describe? And so that's sort of an interesting thing because insofar as the AIs become kind of the omnipotent forces of the world, We kind of want to set it up so that we tell the AIs, this is the thing we want you to do, and we don't want to ever deviate from that, because as soon as you deviate, you might sort of do the wrong thing. The problem with that is that then you're in a situation of saying, okay, in 2018, we're going to invent the constitution of the AIs, and we're going to lock it down, and it's never going to change for the rest of history. And that's clearly not a very good idea, because that's been a thing that's been seen. For example, you know, there are religious traditions where basically the idea is, let's set up a set of laws and let's lock it down for the rest of history. And generally people have not been super happy with that idea. And I think that that's effectively the situation that we're in now, is if we're going to make a constitution for the AIs, we either have to have some wiggle room. And the question is, who determines what wiggles in that wiggle room? Because if the AIs are the omnipotent forces, so to speak, then they're going to be the things that can sort of control what happens. And the question is then how do we deal with that kind of extra sort of wiggle room? If you look at the actual constitutions that countries have in the world, they sort of fall into three classes, I think, from just looking through them. I mean, one class is, you know, one of the questions is, how do you change the constitution? Okay, so you've set it up at year X, 1776 or whatever it was, and then you say, you know, how do you change it? So the answer in some countries is, you say, well, it's basically a democracy, but you want a really, you know, high level of democracy. You want a large fraction of everybody to agree that you should change it. That's strategy number one. Strategy number two is, somewhere there is a supreme ruler and that person will decide. And strategy number three, from what I could tell, which seemed to be in the Soviet kind of tradition, was things get so complicated and have so many committees within whatever, that it might be almost an undecidable question whether the thing can actually get changed in the end. So it sort of gets mired in bureaucracy for 100 years or something like this. But it's sort of in principle possible, but you don't even know whether it's possible. None of these are very satisfactory answers. And I think that's one of the sort of unsolved problems of this is, you know, first step is to even be able to describe what you want the AIs to do. And you can't, you know, you might say, well, let's add an ethics chip to every self-driving car. This is a pretty silly idea. You can probably encode some number of human laws, for example, and that's a reasonable thing to do. But to have some sort of overarching sort of mathematical definition doesn't seem possible. There's another issue, which is, okay, so if we look at kind of, if we sort of start imagining the future of human history and sort of how it relates to all these questions about AI and things like that. So, you know, if we look at the way human history has played out so far and we ask what will change in the future, there are a couple of things that will change in the future, I suspect. One of them is that, if you look sort of at the whole history of life, one of the issues is, how do things get conveyed through time? So one thing that happens is, well, there's genetics and genomics and, you know, a certain amount about what's been, quotes, learnt in the world is conveyed by the progress of sort of the genomics of organisms. That is, you know, natural selection has learnt from the fact that this works in the environment, this doesn't, something that affects the genome, and that's passed through successive generations of the organism. Then the next idea in the sort of world of organisms is the idea of learning stuff. And so at some point in history, you know, nervous systems became sophisticated enough that within the life of one organism, you could learn stuff. And that meant that even if you got it slightly wrong, even if natural selection got things slightly wrong, and you made a creature that did something that by its genomics would do something kind of dumb, it could still learn to not do that dumb thing during its life. And so the first sort of way of doing that was the way that things like we learn to see in our visual system and so on, which is sort of automatic, unsupervised learning effectively, where we're basically just, you know, by the nature of the things that we experience in the world, our nervous system gets some certain features, it sort of discovers certain features, like it discovers, you know, objects and it discovers edge detection and things like this. So that was kind of the idea, and pretty much that's the idea for the last couple of billion years of life on Earth. And then pretty much in our species, the big idea was human language and the fact that it was possible to take what is essentially an abstraction of an idea and move it and sort of transmit it from one organism to another. And that's something, you know, probably some versions of it exist to some extent in other organisms, but that's kind of the big idea that made our species, that's the sort of the big thing that made our species presumably take off, was the fact that instead of, you know, learning, abstract learning in brains that was done by one member of the species could actually be transported to another member of the species by just telling it to the other person, so to speak. And so this is, so why does language, what does language mean? I mean, insofar as if you have two identical brains, you could imagine doing essentially a memory transplant from one brain to another. Well, at least you could if those brains had everything encoded in the same way and had all had all the same experiences. But essentially, unless you're in the sort of the perfect hive mind of everything has not only the same brain but also the same experiences, you don't get to do memory transfers like that, because as soon as you have any diversity in the experience, the way things are encoded will be different, and you don't get to just sort of, you know, take a lump of memory here and transplant it into that. So the way you have to do it is instead to have some symbolic representation of what happened, some representation that is not at the level of here are the individual weights for the neural net or whatever, but they're instead at some sort of higher level of description, so that the thing that comes out of the brain of one organism, so to speak, can be re-imprinted, re-implanted in the brain of the other organism without having in a way that there can be that sort of receiving brain can re-encode it for its own purposes. So, but that's been, you know, kind of this idea of language is a pretty important idea. One kind of wonders, you know, when the first sort of Paleolithic folk or whoever they were, you know, had the idea of language, where people started using language, did they imagine that civilization would be the result of that? Probably not. Very hard to imagine that. And, you know, what are the consequences of having that form of communication? It's not easy to foresee what the consequences would be. But one of the things that's interesting now is we have kind of another level of communication, which is what we get with knowledge-based computer languages, like Wolfram Language. Actually, it's the only example. But but in principle, it's kind of a category. But, you know, a knowledge-based language has the feature that it expresses things about the world, but it does it in a way which can, in fact, be run reproducibly and precisely on, because there is a precise definition for the interpreter of that language. So that's sort of an interesting thing, because it gives us another level of kind of ways to communicate stuff through time. I mean, one way is the way that, you know, humans do it, where it's all written down in books or it's communicated by videos or whatever else. But there's another way, which is just write a bunch of code that represents these things about the world and do it in a way that can be precisely ingested by, in that case, the AIs, or in principle, the humans too. I mean, one of the things I've been interested in is the notion of smart contracts, of legal contracts that can represent things in a way that can be precisely executed. And so, you know, when you write a legal contract, it's trying to say, this is what I want to have happen. But the way it works is it's sort of written roughly in English, except really it's written in legalese, because one wants something that's a little bit more precise than ordinary English. But sort of the limiting case of that is, well, just write it in code, and, you know, the lawyers of the future will not be writing English, they'll be writing code, and the code will define what one wants to have happen in the world. And so we can see, you know, a bunch of experiments we've already done on this kind of thing, but the end result of that will be that there's sort of a way of representing things that is, that's both represents real things in the world, not just pure abstractions, but actual things in the world, actual, you know, tables and chairs and things like that, but also is something that is precise and symbolic and computable and so on. And, you know, I've been interested in actually building such a symbolic discourse language. I think it's, I had originally thought, you know, it's something people were interested in the 1600s, went out of, people thought it was too hard for the last 300 years or so. I think we're finally at the point where we can actually do it and have something that makes sense. It's sort of an interesting thing, because in a sense the making a symbolic discourse language is taking the meaning of something and taking, you go from ordinary language to pure, precise meaning. And so in ordinary language we have all sorts of fluffy, poetic stuff. The goal here is to go to sort of a level of precise symbolic meaning. It's the same thing we have to do in Wolfenhafer. Somebody will ask it some fluffy, complicated question, and we'll decide that question is, you know, how many turkeys are there in Turkey or something. But they will have asked that question in some more elaborate way with a lot more words and so on. And so we're sort of crushing out the poetry to get to the sort of symbolic representation. Now, when it comes to things about the world, what I've kind of realized is that there are things that we can already describe in Wolfram language, for example, that and then there are things that we can't yet describe. So a typical example might be, I want a piece of chocolate. So chocolate, we know all about it. We got all its nutrition characteristics. We know how much, you know, vitamin A is in it, how much magnesium is in it, everything about it. Even a piece of chocolate, we know how big the pieces of chocolate typically are. We know for lots of different brands, we know all kinds of stuff. So we understand the piece of chocolate part of that. But the I want part of that, we don't understand. We don't have a way to represent that. And so that's the thing that I've been interested in understanding, and sort of the big kind of breakthrough that I suppose that I had a while ago was realizing that we've sort of already solved the problem, which is we already know that in Wolfram language, we are taking concepts which in everyday language might be quite vague, and we're kind of making special symbolic versions of those. So for example, the function times for multiplication. In Wolfram language, times represents some very definite thing that's multiplying numbers or polynomials or whatever else. In the world at large, there could be all kinds of different meanings to the word times that would be quite much more general than that. But we're just saying that particular, in Wolfram language, we're going to use the word times, which people know roughly what it means from just their everyday experience, and we're going to use it in this precise way. So another example of that would be, which we haven't done yet, is, you know, I am going to eat a piece of chocolate. Okay, how do you represent, what does eat mean? Well, eat could be a very general kind of thing that might be represented in everyday language. You might say, you know, a function eats its arguments, but you might also say a person eats food. But let's decide that when we say eat in our precise symbolic language, we only mean the person eats food version of that. So we're making use of the fact that people know roughly what we're talking about because we're using the same word eat, but then we're saying we have a precise symbolic meaning for that. And there are various attributes that we can, as soon as we know that it's eat in that sense, we can deduce all sorts of things from that. And so kind of the problem of making the symbolic discourse language is sort of reduced to the problem of categorizing things in the world and sort of making these classes of constructs. For example, let's say motion, to move from this place to that place. Once you have a sense of motion, that a thing moves from this place to that place, there are many different kinds of motion. You can start cataloging. That's just like you can catalog, you know, cities in the world or types of chemical elements or whatever else. But the kind of the logical concept of motion is the same for all of them, or you can choose to make it. You can choose to say that's what we're describing, and anything else is some kind of extra, requires extra description and so on. So anyway, this is kind of the step is to, you know, define this kind of symbolic discourse language, which allows one as a practical matter to make smart contracts and things. Then sort of the exciting thing one gets to do there is do things like write the constitution for the AIs in terms of that kind of symbolic discourse language. But in general, that's a language which says what one wants to have happen in the world. And that's what's important. You know, you start from what you want to have happen in the world, and then your technology has the role of automating that and trying to make it happen as efficiently as possible. But if we look at kind of the large scale span of human history, we're at the point right now where lots of things are, where we've succeeded in automating lots of stuff. We've also had the fortunate feature that a bunch of the technology we've made is fairly cheap. So it's pretty widely spread out in the world. It might be, you know, it used to be the case that, 30, 35 years ago, when I started using computers, I had really fancy computers. I had much fancier computers. You know, I had computers that cost a large multiple of the minimum cost of a computer, and those computers were much better than the computers that were, you know, the amateur kit type computers. Well, now, because of the way that sort of the industrial revolution of consumer electronics has worked, everybody has the same types of computers. There's very little distinction between the fanciest and the generic, so to speak. So this is sort of a fortunate feature. It's not obvious that things would have worked out that way. It happens to have worked out that way. Hasn't yet worked out that way. And medical technology probably will. Where it's sort of what is possible becomes also easy and therefore quite cheap and quite widely distributed. But there's still, if we look at kind of what happens in human history, there are all kinds of things that, there's still certain kinds of scarcity that exist. There's lots of scarcity in the world, but there are certain very generic kinds of scarcities. For example, one of the most obvious forms of scarcity is that human lives are finite. And that's one of the things that's sort of a big feature of the human condition, so to speak, probably won't continue that way. I think that the interesting, the question, nobody still understands why aging happens. It doesn't happen in all organisms. It unfortunately happens in humans right now. But the question of why it happens and whether one can kind of, whether even at a biological level, there's just some sort of, well, aging happens because in evolution it was actually a good thing to have the old guys die off, so to speak. Maybe it's a good thing even in present times, who knows. But the fact is that that may have been an evolutionarily significant thing, and it could be that it's just, it's just a switch. You flip the switch and then, the system doesn't work that way. Or it could be that there's just, the system, that our physiology is just such that it gets kind of progressively sort of bashed around, and eventually the thing, like most mechanical devices, sort of falls apart. I actually think there's sort of a question there. If we look at computer systems, there's a direct analog to what happens with medical systems. That is, if you have an operating system for a computer, it will run for a while. Things will happen to it. It will start getting sluggish. Some sort of bugs will occur and so on. And eventually, splat, it crashes. And then you can restart it, sort of same code, same genomic material. In a sense, next generation gets restarted, and the operating system, cheerfully runs through its, through its early years, so to speak. Sometimes it will have some kind of infant mortality thing where you boot the operating system and something will go wrong immediately. But so that there's a pretty interesting analogy between sort of what is there in the kind of world of complex software systems and what's there in our medical situation. The complex software systems world, you can in principle measure everything. In practice, it's hard to do that because there's sort of a Heisenberg-Heisenbug type principle that, that which is measured doesn't necessarily behave the same way as if it wasn't measured. But still, in a first approximation, this is something that one can do. Now the question is, well, what happens? If one can see sort of the analogs of human physiological decay in computer systems, first question is, can one see that, and does one see things like the Gompertz distribution of exponentially increasing probability of death and things like that in these systems? I don't even know the answer to that. And the second thing is, okay, so if you see that, can you fix it? And unfortunately, I think it's a little bit like one of these Gödel things. That's a little bit like, can you write human laws that will constrain, can you write laws, smart contracts that will constrain things to only work the way you want and not anything but the way you want? It's sort of the same kind of thing. It's the same kind of thing where you're saying, well, how do I tweak this running system so that it will keep going forever in some form of keeping going forever? Because it's no good to keep going forever not doing anything, because that's kind of no fun. It's got to keep going forever doing the things that we sort of want humans that are living forever to do, so to speak. And I think that's a non-trivial thing to see how to do. But so that's kind of the biological version of immortality, so to speak, which we don't know how to do yet from a molecular biology point of view. Although we can certainly imagine certain ways that could work, involving there's some sort of interface between algorithmic drugs, that is, molecules, drugs typically are molecules that go in and they bind to some particular site and then they do what they do. An algorithmic drug will be something where it kind of looks around at the environment and tries to figure out what to do. And there's kind of a continuous gradation from that to having something which operates more like a biological cell or some cell in the immune system or some such other thing, where it's figuring out lots of stuff about what to do and then deciding what to do. That can happen at the level of an individual molecule or some larger level, but then it's not You know, it eventually becomes something which is essentially equivalent to what exists in the biological system itself. And so I think that's a way to sort of see that correspondence. But whether you know, this whole question of sort of the biological immortality thing, how that will play out, I'm not sure. One thing that is a really frustrating feature of kind of watching the progress of these things is the one thing that's a pretty obvious feature of that is the whole cryonics business of how do you take an organism and just freeze it and put it on pause for a while. Eventually it will be figured out how to do that. It will have a big practical effect on lots of things. And what's frustrating is it probably isn't hard, but basically nobody's trying to figure out how to do it. And it reminds me a great deal of what happened with cloning, where for years, people like me who were just curious about these things would ask people, you know, okay, you know, lower organisms can be cloned, why can't we clone mammals? Well, it's like, oh, well, there are all these reasons why it's harder, blah, 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 blah. And eventually this procedure, which is totally weird and very Frankensteinian with electric shocks and things like this, got invented, which allows one to clone mammals. And I think the same thing exactly will happen with cryonics. And it will have a bunch of practical effects. It won't be as important as sort of the practicality of having some sort of engineered biological immortality. But of course, then the issue is the sort of the other thing that will happen is, you know, over in time, the artificial neural network will become the real neural network because it's not going to be long before we can have a pretty good emulation of what brains actually do. I mean, we can already see the little pieces of that in the neural nets we have. You know, we'll be able to take something and just in silicon, so to speak, reproduce what brains do. It's not terribly surprising. We've managed to reproduce what lots of other stuff does. This is not, you know, brains happen to have been a bit harder, but it's not going to be that surprising. Now, there'll be all kinds of issues like can you get, you know, given a person who has all these memories, can you actually read out those memories into a sort of a digital version of that brain? Not obvious. You know, maybe if you take the brain, you slice it up, which means you don't have a functioning brain anymore, then you can read those memories out. Maybe there'll be some optogenetics, you know, funky thing that can have little, where there are little critters that run around through the brain and start and make measurements and sort of figure out this synapse has this and this and this, and then you are reproducing what the brain does. Maybe sort of simpler, people like me kind of record all kinds of data about themselves and what they do, and maybe all that will be necessary is to just, you know, I've always wanted a bot of myself, is to basically feed, you know, all of the email I've sent and received for the last 30 years, plus lots of other kinds of things into the system, and maybe that will be enough to reproduce, to reconstruct, because certainly I don't remember everything that's happened to me, and maybe it's enough to just have that, you know, n-gram of what's represented in email and other kinds of things.
You've been listening to part 1 of 3 in our series on the future of AI and civilization with Stephen Wolfram. Tune in for the next episode where Stephen talks about the possibility of digitized humanity as a box of a trillion souls and AI as an alien intelligence. Next time on the Stephen Wolfram Podcast. For more information on Stephen's blog posts, books, and live streams, visit StephenWolfram.com.